Okay, I want to greet you in the name of Jesus this morning. This topic I was assigned here, conflicting interests, competing interests. Topic description says, I'm chairman. My brother-in-law, whose son is causing trouble at school, is secretary. My daughter is a teacher. How can I involve myself objectively? Oh, and I'm also a father. Busy business owner, trustee at church, Sunday morning superintendent, etc. I hardly have enough leftover mental space to give to the school, but I was voted on by a trusting brotherhood. That's something that's familiar to all of us, but it could go a lot of different directions. My thoughts went to resolving conflict, how to build and restore trust, time management, and leadership are some of the things I'd like to look at. And I want your help, especially when I say things you don't agree with, or there's different angles. Speak up. You can interrupt me at any time. I'm going to try to moderate it more as a discussion rather than a topic. We have this saying, make ends meet. Most of the time we think about making ends meet financially. We have enough money to pay the bills, use the money that we have to pay our expenses, adjust our expenses according to our income. There's another aspect of making ends meet. Back when they had sailing ships, they had lots of ropes, and they had to make the ends meet with whatever rope they had available. Rope would break. So I have this picture in my mind of life as we're hanging on to rope, pulling the ends together. A lot of times in life we're caught in that situation, and we're pulling on the ends to make it meet. It takes years of patient, persistent effort to achieve any type of a goal that we might have, and that's what life is like. Sometimes the ends meet, but we can never tie it off and think it's good now. The next thing we know, we're in the situation again where we're pulling on the ends to try to bring things together to make ends meet. And that's in this thing of competing interests, competing relationships. If you look at your handouts, I have a few examples here. Relationships should not compete, but in reality they often do. We are protective of those closest to us, and sometimes our human weakness creates awkward situations. A parent is very protective and defensive of their child who is making trouble on the playground, being a bad sport and a fledgling bully. The teacher asks for help because of the parent's attitude. How would you speak into that situation if you had to deal with that? What would you do? What if the parent's on the school board?
That presents an extra challenge, for sure.
Say again?
That presents an extra challenge, for sure.
Yeah. How do we talk to people without it turning into an accusatory argument? What about B? What about my cousin's child who feels picked on and targeted by the teacher and is backed by overprotective parents?
It seems like there's two dynamics that are maybe competing for priority.
Mm-hmm.
One is family relationship or authority, and the other is a problem. Child is representing the problem,
mm-hmm.
but they're also, in conjunction, a relative. Okay, so in some of those scenarios, you can't remove the person from the problem, but if you talk about exactly, if you identify what the problem itself is,
mm-hmm.
then you can separate those two dynamics and you put the problem as priority.
Right.
And it's not your fault.
Right, exactly.
I've often heard where in business, I guess, is a big, when you have employees or even partners or whatever, attack the problem, not the person.
Mm-hmm. It's extremely important. Be able to identify the problem without feeling so personally invested that I feel personally attacked by or come across that way to others.
Like it's not the parent's fault that the child is doing mm-hmm. this. It's like, is there selfishness involved?
Mm-hmm.
Then how do we cure the selfishness problem?
Right, right. Thank you.
One of the words that Thomas used there, very insignificant, is he said, what the problem is. So often we want to talk about why there's a problem because we feel like we're getting at the root of things.
Because the way you were raised, or your dad, or your
right.
attitude. Yeah.
Being overprotective, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
But to talk about the what is actually a lot more productive.
Mm-hmm.
Just say, in the words of one of my mentors, he was really good at using this phrase, and it was really effective for me. I thought you might want to know what.
That's a good lead-in.
And then, as you operate off that premise, very often the other party will wave you in on the why.
Right.
But if they don't wave you in on the why, it probably isn't safe to be there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. What about C, if my daughter's teaching and I'm on the board? That can create an interesting situation. I haven't faced that personally, but I related with people who have. What are some things we should think about if our child is teaching and we're also on the school board? How can we avoid siding with, remain impartial?
I think it's important that having a multiple board members in a scenario like that,
mm-hmm.
say how we feel, but let the rest of the board speak into the situation and say how they feel about it.
Excellent.
And that way, I think it would appear to others that we have a balanced view.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what we need.
Mm-hmm. Intentionally defer if there's a potential conflict of interest, rely on the others. Yeah. Sure, I'm thankful to not be on the board by myself.
I haven't faced this situation in particular, but looking at that, put the hand up, use a schedule rather than a list.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if I were to be in that, I think I would proactively figure out what my daughter's weaknesses are and what her strengths are.
Mm-hmm. Certainly in our families.
So if you have a proactive measure, okay, this lands into the weakness of my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Be careful.
Mm-hmm.
About protecting the actual weakness.
Right.
You want strength.
Right, 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 right. Overprotection produces weakness.
Right.
Yeah, and to think ahead on that, thank you for that. That is an area where I am not very strong in is being intentionally proactive in that type of a thing. Appreciate that. Anything else in this first section?
We should be aware that we can discuss and
daughter teacher. We can discuss that situation at home in ways that are very non-productive. And if we pretty much have our discussion and know which way things need to go according to our perspective and determine that that's the way it's got to be before we get to a broader meeting.
Right.
Resist the urge to actually have some discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least some types of discussion.
And relating to your daughter at home, before you get to the board meetings, I think that is very good advice.
And that can happen too. If my brother is on the board, it's going to be assumed the brothers have their heads together, especially if you work together.
Exactly.
And that actually is the beginning of it. That's why I think that's probably why churches split, is we develop these special interest groups or groups that, coalesce around a particular issue.
It is.
And then something comes along that just formalizes that division.
Right, right. Be able to work together as a group rather than devolve into self-protective special interest groups just destroys the cohesiveness of a group. Now, I didn't get too far into this before I was thinking about resolving conflict, which in my mind is the same as building trust. Where there is trust, conflict is less. And without trust, good things don't happen. John was talking to us a lot about that just now, about how essential trust is. So I have a few things down here. We'll go through them. There is much, much more that could be said about that big subject. Things that came to my mind. A, never give up on your brother. Often in our families, we do pretty well with this, our blood relation. My brother is making very unwise choices. As a hypothetical, do I just write him off and say I won't talk to you again? Most of us don't do that. We stand by our brother, even if we see that he is making really bad decisions that ruin his life, and we never give up on him. To apply that broader, certainly in the local church, how we relate to each other in our local church, which our schools are an arm of the church most of the time. That's a challenge for me, to feel the same way. Never give up on my brother, even if he's the one that I struggle with, that I have such a hard time relating to, and I see from my perspective that he's making unwise decisions, and I would just like to maintain that commitment to wishing him the best and continue to press ahead in the relationship. That's essential in building trust. So these first ones here are just sort of different points. Maybe I'll just run through them with my thoughts and then... So B, the words we say and how we say them. I'm not a very good communicator in this respect. So that's probably why it stands out to me. The wrong words or the right words in the wrong way really damage relationships. If we commit to speaking thoughtfully and gently, no matter what happens, no matter what the situation is. And C, negativity and positivity or versus positivity. If I come across in an accusing, negative way, the instant, instinctive response is to hit back at that. And then it accumulates and spirals out of control. Negativity, to come across that way, does not help. So we should be positive, but there's, if we're just relentlessly positive, it can come across as phony, like not very real, right? So we need to be positive people, but honest. Not like a salesman who's overselling the product, but be genuine and honest in our positive attitude, in ways to relate. And D is respect. Treat others with respect. Underlying this is the respect toward others, toward each other, seeing ourselves and others in an honest way as all in the same human situation. Respect, condescension is like the opposite of respect. Respect reaches out equally in a level, not down or up. You have any questions or insights? Anything to add to that? All right, let's look at E. Some people are consistently pleasant, positive, and productive. Others are habitually negative, grumpy, and a drag. What makes the difference? If you think of people, you can think of people that are like that. Some people are just, it seems like, genuinely happy and positive, pleasant to be around, productive people. Others always see the negative. No matter what comes up about somebody, there'll be a negative comment. What makes the difference?
I can completely understand what you're saying, because I've known people on both sides of this, and it feels like people with a negative attitude about, it doesn't matter what it is, they'll find something bad or something wrong with any situation. It doesn't matter what it is, even if it's good. So I think, isn't it a choice for us? I think it is, personally. For me, I've been on all my life, I've felt like I've been a positive person most of the time. I mean, there are times when you get down with feeling, but we remember that we've seen the sign, no bad days, right? But if we have Christ within us, that can be a reality. We're looking on the bright side. It doesn't mean we're going to ignore issues and problems. You know, I've said already, I've been a boss most of my life, and my foreman, sometimes I would have to tell him, look, if you are having a bad day, the rest of the people are going to have a bad day too. So it's up to us how we want to affect those around us, and it's more real than we think, than you are.
We are in control. Thank you for that. It is up to us. We can choose to do this. What stands out to me is how cumulative it is. Our brains work. I was listening to a book recently about a person who was doing some studies, was a psychologist, I think, who was also doing some studies with brain scans. And our negative response is easier. It is more of an instinctive response. It is more difficult to respond with control and be positive about life in general. And what happens is we form habits, and our brain activity goes back to what it knows. And so if I spend my life being a generally a positive, helpful attitude, and I reform those habits over and over again, it becomes more habitual to me. And the same is true with the negative sense, that eventually I'm 50 years old And my first response to a situation is just negative because I've spent all my life being that way. And then it's pretty difficult. It comes into a habitual, almost addiction that we have to retrain our brain to improve. And it can be done, but it just is amazing how important it is. Our responses and attitudes make a difference. And the longer we do it, the easier it is.
Could I suggest that they're not in competition with each other, though?
Okay.
I think maybe that God created both as strengths for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
My particular strength would be the positive side. And so, but your greatest strength is also your greatest weakness,
mm-hmm.
in respect. So, just taking business again for an example, there's a brother in our church that he's a pessimist to the hill, and I just and we have open discussions about business ideas,
mm-hmm.
and he knows he's there to shoot holes in everything
that I
come up with.
Devil's advocate all the time.
And I'm always bringing out the good part in what he's doing.
Right.
And so that up front, mm-hmm. is the intention of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Difficult conversations to have, but they're also fun.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're bringing out another side. And so when we're working together with them, I'm gleaning a whole other set of ideas,
mm-hmm.
that I never once would have thought. Or in practicality, what's going on? So, like in school, it's a very deep subject, the education of our children.
Right.
And there are people that are going to see a bear behind every bush.
Right. Potential pitfalls.
And you can go in circles with that.
Right.
You also have the people that have new ideas. Because there's an endless amount of, mm-hmm. of visionary things to do with education.
Unrealistic.
But when you can pull that together to a unified vision.
Right.
And you have trust, you have respect, then that ball can be moved,
mm-hmm.
further forward than either one of those could have done by themselves.
Yeah, collective strength, balancing each other out.
But if you understand those
strengths
and weaknesses of both up front as a board,
mm-hmm.
Then it no longer gets personal, because I think it can get, this is better, or this is better.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever got the biggest shoe.
Right. Yeah, it's not necessarily, that's a great point. I'm glad you brought that out. In different views, like take a more pessimistic or a more optimistic view of life. But underneath that, in how we relate to each other, if I start, it's like innocent until proven guilty. We need to have that premise in mind as we relate with each other. It's like Malcolm Gladwell said in his book, Talking to Strangers, you can live perpetually suspicious, and you might find that bad actor that other people don't. But that devolves to a place where I can't function in society anymore. I'm forded up with a shotgun somewhere, sure that something bad is looming over me. Or I can extend, I can have an attitude of innocent until proven guilty, be trusting, knowing that I will probably miss some criminals and grifters out there. But the cost is too high to be perpetually suspicious. I guess would underlie that. Being optimistic and pessimistic, that is what we do, where we do not want to go, is be distrustful as a default of other people. It's a thought. Yeah, I'm in the middle. I'm balanced out, right? Yeah.
I think what I tend to do is I listen to someone talking, or let's say a board situation. You listen to someone talking, you say, oh, that's so and so. You just kind of let it go to the top.
Right. Right.
I think that's a challenge for me, kind of tune out. I think as a board, I think that's one thing I need to think about. Okay, what can I take from what that brother's saying on a face value instead of all that's in the money?
Absolutely. I mean, that's right down to that fundamental value of rather than look at all the negative and just tear each other down with that is the positive. What can I get from this situation? What can I get from this person? Look on the positive side of things.
So what would be some hallmarks of a relationship where I think it might be the sages that tell us that it's hard to fly like an eagle while strutting with turkeys.
It's hard to what?
It's hard to soar like an eagle when strutting with turkeys. At some point, we do need to choose who we're going to associate with. So what would be some hallmarks of a relationship? If this is not really a good place to, or not really a good person to actually be with.
You're saying at what point do we say this relationship is not worth it?
Yes. Or it's not productive. Or don't we do that?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Bible actually, let's go to something a little bit more practical. The Bible does say he that walketh is wise in each other's life.
Right.
So, or do we just say no? All associations, when it comes to this thing of negativity, and whatnot, are there no boundaries to that?
Hmm. Well, speak more into that, Jonathan.
Well, I'm asking.
What do y'all think about that? Say again?
Point A.
Never give up on your brother.
With that, I think that's a really good point. Never give up. But one thing that does happen is your hope may never change, your love may never change, but your relationship changes.
Yeah.
The dynamics of it change somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because it would be a drag on you.
Mm-hmm.
And because it don't. So I don't know how much that carries over here. It's not like you would shun them or not be with them or not.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some things sometimes where you wouldn't associate with them.
Right, right. In socially, or is that sort of what you were getting at, Jonathan? Mm-hmm.
I think what Joel said is very insightful for many situations, but when this is a brother that in the church, I mean, I really admire what Titus was saying there about the brother that's consistently deadly on the trampoline, so to speak, and somehow benefiting from that. But I like to jump, I like to soar, you know, and so
you can break your leg, you know.
All of that. How to bring that into practicality is, I guess, what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Are you suggesting we need a clear-cut way to fire school board members?
That would be included.
I've never heard how we do that, so how does that happen?
Right.
I really think that we can, but I'm with Jonathan. At what point is that too much of a drag? I don't know that I have the answer for that, but it was a new thought for me to see that as a benefit to me.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And maybe with the tough conversations that he was talking about, maybe our positive outlook can also benefit the negative person in ways that we may not know.
Right, right. As long as there's an openness and a trust there in the relationship, it can be a balancing, helpful. I have a brother-in-law that sees that. He will point out the problems with the idea or the situation. But there is a good relationship where ideas, you can circle around things and look at it from different viewpoints and benefit. Mm-hmm.
And that is the premise that we get rid of board members if they can't follow.
Right.
And that's made by the church.
By the church.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. there's a structure, at least we have set in place. And then, so our board members is revolving quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's a mission.
Right.
And when it becomes detrimental to that, there's steps to be taken. But you usually can straighten it out before it gets too far gone.
Mm-hmm.
I think now every situation is going to be different. But I think personal responsibility for the conflict is premium.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a verse that says that God won't tempt you with anything that you are not able to bear. So what does that mean?
That's a good question.
We go forever with that. Is it saying you won't see the problem if you can't take care of it?
Hmm. There's resources. I'm not able to stand. I'm not tapping into the right resources. I like what you're saying there. The school has a goal, has a mission. You say you have a pretty detailed plan or goal for it for your school. That's good. And if somebody is unable to support that, is that odds with it? Now that. With our schools, most of our Christian day schools being associated closely with the church, like the church has the school to teach our children, that, you know, the church has the authority, if somebody is not a born-again Christian, to excommunicate that person if somebody falls away. You know, it'd be something like that, I guess. So let's go on to F. What is the principle guiding actions and attitudes toward others? What is underneath? What principles do we need to live out to relate like we were talking about? Something we can fall back on. What I have here is to view each other not as obstacles, but as people whose values, goals, and thinking matter just as much as my own does. Relate to each other in that, like we already talked about this, but even law enforcement does training in that respect to view criminals as other people, not as obstacles or objects. I think that is a fundamental value, And it's very interesting to think about how our core values, if we talk about our core values, what is most important to me? What is the most important thing, value in my life? And then what is the most important value in your life? And those might be different, but they're almost always compatible with each other, if we break it down to that. Have anything to add to that? Exactly. We are all created in the image of God. Fellow humans. If we could only see that and live that out more, we would have more real unity. Not based on superficial, but fundamental unity. Mm-hmm.
Like he created me.
Unconditionally.
It's baseline.
Yeah.
Attitude.
And we need to be thinking, am I true to those principles? Jesus, can criticism be constructive? I think we already talked about that. I think we need to avoid anything that is negative or blaming, but it's a plan. I can't clearly articulate it right now, but there was a fair amount of discussion that I was thinking ahead, thinking this is how criticism is constructive. Does anybody have any question or thought about that? And time. The last one I have here in this section is trust takes time. That stands out to me clearly right now. How much time, you know, a couple years, we just get to start, we're just started knowing each other in a couple years' time. It takes a long time to really know each other well and build up that fundamental trust. And then when trust is broken and needs to be repaired, needs to be rebuilt through whatever life has brought us and whatever mistakes I've made and the other person has made, and trust needs to be rebuilt, that takes a lot of time. So let's skip the time management part of it, and let's go down to leadership. A, what are characteristics of a good leader? Humility.
Now, as far as the, so my wife has, that guard is still out. Is that correct?
I have one sentence here in bold. Leadership should see themselves primarily as moderators rather than having authority to make decisions. Humility. Is that the 5 minute bell? Okay. B is, what is the biblical leadership style? So there are different styles of leadership. Autocratic, authoritarian, participative, or democratic, laissez-faire, free-reign leadership. What's the biblical style of leadership? There it is. Servant leadership. I have a couple paragraphs here about servant leadership. It's both a leadership philosophy and set of leadership practices. Traditional leadership generally involves the accumulation and exercise of power by one at the top of the pyramid, by comparison. The servant leader shares power, puts the needs of others first, and helps people develop and perform as highly as possible. Servant leadership turns the power pyramid upside down. Instead of the people working to serve the leader exists to serve the people. When leaders shift their mindset and serve first, they unlock purpose and ingenuity in those around them, resulting in higher performance and engage fulfilled employees. A servant leader's purpose should be to inspire and equip the people they influence. And here's a quote that I'm not sure who wrote this, but I found this years ago. The highest type of ruler is one of whose existence the people are barely aware. Next comes one whom they love and praise, and next comes one whom they fear, and next comes one whom they despise and defy. When you are lacking in faith, others will be unfaithful to you. The sage is self-effacing, scanty of words. When his task is accomplished and things have been completed, all the people say, "We ourselves have achieved it." So in conclusion, our thinking about competing interests and the time, you know, the tension that exists, that we keep pulling on the ends to make them meet, and things fall apart, our expectation should be that the struggle continues on earth here. This year, I've been struggling with a very persistent sense of futility, sort of emptiness. I'm not sure exactly what brought this on, but how much difference am I, or is the kingdom of God really growing in the big picture? We live in a fallen world, we recognize that. So I want to have the strength to go on even if things seem to fall apart. And I know that there's always more work to do. No matter how much I do, it's not going to actually be enough. And I was inspired recently by a short story from J.R.R. Tolkien. He was writing the Lord of the Rings series in the late 1800s, early 1900s, I believe. He was a contemporary of C.S. Lewis in England. And it started to overwhelm him. And he thought there's no way he can possibly finish it was a very ambitious project. And he wrote this short story called Leaf by Niggle. If you have an opportunity, get that and read it. Leaf by Niggle. Niggle was a man who was a painter. And he was working on this painting, but he was not a very efficient worker. He got sidetracked easily, and he had a neighbor who he helped a lot and was always demands on his time. And this is a bit of a longer short story. It's not a short story. And he had one painting that was the big thing he wanted to accomplish with his life. He wanted to get this painting done. And he kept working on it, and it was a tree with very detailed leaves. He was good at painting leaves, and it expanded into a whole forest with a mountain behind it, meadow beneath it, opening up into like a whole countryside. And he knew he had to go on a trip. He knew he didn't have a lot of time, but he kept trying to work on this. And then one day, the conductor came and said, "It's time to go." He had to go. He said, "It can't go. It's not done. My painting's not done. I can't go." But he had to go right there. And he said, my life work is going to be wasted. And it was. The painting was destroyed. Some local person kept found part of the painting, one leaf, and displayed it for a while, and then after about 20 years, even that was gone, and there was no memory of Niggle anymore. But the story doesn't end there. He was on a train to the heavenly country, and eventually he got there. He got there to the heavenly country, and he was let off the train at this place where there was a bicycle with his name on it, and he started riding the bicycle. And pretty soon things started looking familiar. And he saw this tree. He saw the forest and the mountain behind it, and there it was. There was his painting that he had been working on. There it was. I think there is a larger reality of the kingdom of God that really does exist that we can press on in. So thank you for your time.